Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, a delicate subject, but one that, according to all of the experts we've talked with, must be discussed. Suicide.
The more that we talk about it out loud, without shame, and acknowledge that it is a mental health condition or a health condition that is treatable, I think the lower the stigma and the more likely people are to get help.
Yvette Hourigan hears about this daily. She heads the Kentucky Lawyers Assistance Program, first of its kind in the nation, co-founded by former state Supreme Court Justice Bill Cunningham.
So it's a balancing act. Do we talk about it, not talk about it? I think we have to weigh the good and the bad. And if we can talk about it in a way that we can come with constructive answers, I think that we need to talk about it in spite of the fact there might be some ramifications that are not really good.
In this hour, we will be talking about suicide, and there may be sensitive details that could be triggering to some. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is a hotline for individuals in crisis or for those looking to help somebody who's experiencing a crisis. To speak with a trained listener, simply dial or text 988, or you can contact the crisis text line by texting TALK, T-A-L-K, to 741-741. Suicide prevention advocates have developed guidelines for news media coverage of suicide deaths. Over 100 studies worldwide have found that risk of contagion is very real, and responsible reporting can change perceptions, dispel myths, inform the public on the complexities of the issue, and when it includes helpful resources and messages of hope and recovery, it can encourage seeking help. We've taken cues from a recent episode of Fresh Air, Terry Gross talking with philosopher, novelist, and essayist Clancy Martin, himself a survivor of multiple attempts to take his own life, and author of How Not to Kill Yourself.
Happily, we have a large scientific literature on how this works. If we speak about details of how a person made an attempt, and those details are sort of easily replicable, then that can have the effect of actually causing people to go out and try to take their own lives in the manner described. So it's best to not to do that. However, if we talk about it in a way such that we provide the context, anxiety, depression, wrestling with the thought of suicidal ideation throughout one's life, it's been shown that talking about suicide actually reduces the effect in the general population, both of suicidal ideation and of suicide attempts. So the media can do this really positive thing by talking about the larger context of a suicide attempt. So that's what I always try to do.
We also consulted with Dr. Melinda Moore, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Eastern Kentucky University and an expert in suicidology.
There's a science around suicide, and we know that broadcasting or printing details can perhaps give people really ideas and can lead to sort of a contagiousness around that particular means of suicide. And so we just don't do that.
We'll hear more from Moore, Hourigan, and Cunningham later in this hour. First, the inspiration for this edition of Eastern Standard. Bruce Simpson is well known in the Lexington legal community. He has practiced land use law for decades. And earlier this year, he made an attempt to end his life, but was prevented by a series of unforeseen circumstances. Bruce Simpson, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
So to begin with, for context, the events that led to you joining us today result at least in part from a lifetime living with untreated depression. Tell us about that and why you never sought treatment.
Well, that's correct. And to be perfectly candid, until this crisis, which culminated in my attempted suicide on January 25th, I was not aware that I had untreated depression. I just thought that was life. If you felt bad or weren't doing well, suck it up. Don't complain. Stop whining. Be a man. And that's what I did. But I had virtually no self-esteem and felt very unworthy for most of my life until my early 40s when I started to experience some success as an attorney, but only because people would tell me, that's a good job you've done, Bruce, and one of my cases might be written up in the newspaper. And I depended on those affirmations of self-worth that finally made me feel good about myself. But I needed to get reinforced with that every so often. And fortunately, for the next 30 years until January of this year, I had gotten those affirmations. And then in January, it all came crashing down.
To back up just a bit from January, in 2022, you began experiencing a series of pretty serious health problems. And then in January of this year, some very difficult news arrived in the mail. What was that, and how did that news affect you?
Yeah, I did have some health problems in 2022. I had a heart condition that required hospitalization. And then a few months later, in May of 2022, I had a brain bleed that required intensive care hospitalization in Lexington, and been hospitalized two or three more times after that for the rest of 2022. In January of 2023, and I would go back to work after all those prior hospitalizations because I love doing what I do as a lawyer. I love helping people and facing challenges, and that's what keeps me going. But in January 22, I opened the mail and read a Court of Appeals decision in a case that was a case that I'd won at the trial court level. And the opinion noted that I'd not filed a brief in that case on appeal. And my first reaction was, of course I filed a brief. I won this case. Why would I not file a brief? But I checked, and I had not filed a brief. And instantly, my reputation and my feelings of self-worth were shattered beyond my ability to describe adequately any words.
And that brought you to the point that brings us here today. And as it happens, through a series of circumstances that were totally out of your control, you survived your very determined attempt to end your life. And to be clear, that was not the outcome that you intended. But here you are today. So how did surviving this shape your thoughts about its meaning and your purpose in life?
Well, for me, I kind of look at it like I was a walking improvised explosive device, in that once I started feeling good about myself and feeling worthy as a human being, that if I ever imagined that that would come to an end, that I'd be humiliated in a public way, that life wouldn't be worth living. So in essence, I'd been waiting 30 years for the right triggering event to set me off. It was on automatic pilot. I was instantly on the point of no return. And as you say, for reasons which certainly defy most people's understanding, I was not successful because I was very determined, as determined as I am when I'm getting ready for to try a case or put a case on before any legislative body or planning commission. I was locked in. I wanted it to happen. I was determined to have it happen, and it didn't. And because it didn't, and I did survive, and I did start receiving treatment and medication, which I had completely disdained before, thought it was totally a waste of time, waste of money, and how is someone going to talk to me and give me medication other than maybe get me high? How is that going to make me feel better? I was very negative towards that mental health treatment. But then when I started to receive it and then I started feeling so much better, it was amazing. I feel better now than I've ever felt in my life, and I wish I'd had this treatment 50 years ago. And because I have a second chance, and because by all rights and intentions, I should not be speaking to you today, I feel like I have to let people know that the bridge is out down the road and there's a better and safer path that you can go if you're depressed like I was and you're at the point of no return, and that you can find happiness, fulfillment. You're not high on drugs. That's not the way medication works. And life can be more enjoyable. And I want people to know that and not go down that point of no return. It is a dark, dark place.
I think it's really important that you emphasize that you don't get a high from these drugs? Because that may discourage people. They may think, well, I'm not going to be able to think clearly. I'm not going to be able to function. But that's not the case.
No. And I was really concerned about that myself because, you know, as an attorney, I want to be sharp. I don't want to be high. And that's not the way antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication work. It calms you down. It makes you less anxious. It helps me think actually more clearly than I've ever thought in my life. I think about issues and cases that I really don't recall thinking about before. It comes a lot easier to me. My speaking in groups and trials and so forth is a lot less anxious. What I want to say comes out a lot smoother and in more of a purposeful manner rather than a kind of a panic on the inside. I always thought I did a pretty good job in speaking, but I really think I'm even better now because of the treatment that I've received. And I'm really blessed, and I'm one of the people to take advantage of the opportunity I know that's there.
Well, that's so interesting, Bruce. I took a look at a 2016 study. It was in the journal Injury Prevention. And according to this study, when stories circulate about people who survive an attempt or share strategies to help deal with suicidal thinking, suicide rates go down, and people report reduced suicidal ideation. And I take it that is your aim in communicating this and to share that possible outcome.
That is correct. And I've learned that from people that I've talked with that are experts in suicide prevention and from the many books that I've read since January the 25th, that having more public discussion, discussing depression as well as suicide more openly, recognizing its prevalence. You know, one person dies by suicide once every 11 minutes in the United States. And when I saw that, I was just blown away. I could not believe it was that frequent. But it is a significant health problem. And it is a subject, depression, suicide, we don't talk about it. I don't recall ever having a conversation with anyone about it except maybe in a whispering context where someone will say, hey, did you know so-and-so died by suicide? And it's kind of in a whispering tone because a family member may be by. But it's not, you know, you can sit around and talk about having your gallbladder taken out or you got a knee replacement or a hip replacement. And everybody's, you know, listens to who your doctor was and how long you were in rehab. I've never had a conversation ever before my experience that someone said they were depressed. But that's like a conversation killer. So I think there's a stigma and a stereotype that where you almost blame the person who's suffering from depression from their own malady. And it's like they're not strong enough to fix themselves. And I confess I felt that way myself about people who said they were depressed. Well, you're just malingering and you're not trying hard enough. And I was obviously clearly wrong, and I regret ever having thinking, much less said that.
It seems as though, as a society, we are beginning to come around to viewing depression as a disease, like cancer, heart disease, which seems like a pretty positive development.
I hope so. I think that, you know, some professional athletes and others have come out and discussed their problems with depression over a period of time, and that's certainly helpful. It's a good start, but it's still a stigma. I've seen it take place in other business contexts where, you know, a prominent member of the business would die by suicide, and it was immediately hushed up. It was not to be discussed or talked about, almost like a COVID-2 had hit the business again. And that's just the wrong way to approach it because, as you pointed out, depression that culminates to the point that you're so miserable that you have to take your own life, when you get to that point, that's one of the worst health problems that you can have, to go against human nature to try to take your own life. But I was there. I was determined. There was no one that was going to dissuade me. And my goodness, I'm so grateful to be here. And I don't want anyone to get to that point. And whatever I can do to cause them to pause and to dissuade them to think differently, I'm intending to do it.
Law, the practice of law, figures into the top 10 professions with high rates of suicide. It's not the top. Veterinarians experience it. People in the construction and extraction industries experience it at high rates. But former State Supreme Court Justice Bill Cunningham, who we're also talking with, has identified two types of pressure in the practice of law. And I'd like to look at each of these and get your take on them, and beginning with the pressing need that is found in all professions, but very much so in law, the heavy obligation of getting it right. There's no two ways. Everybody makes mistakes, but are lawyers held to a much higher standard and can always striving to and yet failing to meet that standard contribute to suicidal thinking?
No question about it. Law is a profession, much like in medicine in some context, where you have to be perfect 100% of the time because people are relying upon you for your advice, for your care, for your protection. You are their protector. It is a high obligation that a lawyer has to protect the best interest of the client who engages their legal services. I don't know of a higher legal duty or ethical duty that another human being can have, but as a lawyer looking after the well-being of another person with regard to legal matter, other than a physician looking after their health. So it is a high duty. It's a high obligation, and we understand that when we become attorneys. But the dilemma, of course, is lawyers are human too, and they are subject to the same frailties and vulnerabilities as the people they represent. And that creates really some serious conflicts when, if you do make a mistake, it's much more difficult to accept and adapt a mistake, as I've experienced, than if you just made a mistake in some other context where you didn't have a high affirmative duty to take care of another person's needs.
While many of us in many walks of life go home at night with problems on our mind, is it fair to say that many lawyers go home not only with their own problems, but also carrying those of the many that they're working with?
No question. I don't think you'll find any lawyer who does any significant amount of work not tell you that they haven't woken up in the middle of the night and thinking, oh, my gosh, did I put that in my pleadings? Did I file that? Did I get this done? Oh, I need to change that. You second-guess yourself constantly. It goes with the territory of being an attorney. I don't know of a way to escape from that, or should you, because, you know, we do care about the people we represent naturally. And also in terms of our obligation as lawyers with respect to our obligation to the Bar Association and the Kentucky Supreme Court and the rules that govern lawyer conduct. It is, you know, a highest affirmative obligation that I'm aware of, that of taking care of another person's legal needs that you have. And it's an extraordinary amount of pressure that goes with that. But we understand that when you become an attorney and you accept it, but it doesn't mean it doesn't create problems because you're still a human being that has subject to the same frailties as everyone else. That's the big problem.
We've seen stats out of the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, that show that in the U.S. at least, suicide is the second leading cause of death among people between 15 and 24. So in this context, it leads me to wonder, does law school adequately prepare future attorneys to manage all these pressures?
No, nowhere close. I don't recall ever having a class. Of course, recognize, you know, I was in law school 40 years ago. I don't know what they're doing these days. But I know as a profession, our culture of practice needs to change. We need to recognize that depression is a legitimate, serious, significant health issue that attorneys have to face and have to deal with. And we need to be more preventive. We need to be more educational. We need to talk about it more. We need to deal with the culture of how firms practice, their expectations of attorneys in terms of what they do and how much money and how many hours they're supposed to bill, particularly for young lawyers coming in. It's a very competitive profession, even within the firm, because you're fighting for promotion, you're fighting to justify your existence, because it is a business. One of the things that law schools do not prepare you for, which has always created a conflict for me, is when you start working, it is a business. It is a business first. It is a service second. I've always viewed the profession of law as a service first and making money second. But it is a business for most law firms if they want to make a profit, and that is the exclusive, purposeful focus of most firms. It is not service first. Now, they will deny that But when it comes to evaluation of what you've done and your performance, it is based upon how many hours you've generated, how many clients have you brought in for others to work on, how much money have you brought into the firm. It is just like any other business in terms of productivity. And that, in my opinion, there needs to be changed and have rewards for other activities that attorneys do besides generating money.
Does the legal culture encourage attorneys to kind of suppress depression and not seek treatment for it to avoid a record so that they can avoid clients finding out, perhaps deciding they don't want them to represent them?
Absolutely, Tom. We have this warrior mentality that's fostered and encouraged to be rough and tough and hard to bluff. And you can't acknowledge any weakness, much less see someone for it. You just got to suck it up and keep going. You don't want anybody to find out about it because you feel like you might get demoted or fired or in some way, not be promoted in the same way as if you didn't disclose it. So there is certainly a strong tendency to keep depression quiet. In contrast to, if you had a cancer or heart disease or something like that, that's more of an acceptable illness than depression.
According to the best evidence that we have, the real key here is how we talk about suicide, whether one-on-one or in a public conversation such as this one. This seems like a good opportunity to talk to somebody who could really address this. How should we talk with a loved one, a friend, or a colleague who confides in us that they are seriously contemplating ending their life?
Well, I think first you need to do a little preparation on how to speak to somebody that's contemplating that. And there are lay classes that can provide some assistance if you do some research. But that then makes it the obligation of the individual. It's not something that's ready-made because we don't publicize those kinds of courses, that kind of publicity and social media and the like. So it's in the public domain to enough of the extent that people pick up on it. And so unless you happen to be sensitive to a family member or a friend that comes to you with that, you're really at a loss of what to do and what to say. You don't want to trigger anything that make it worse, certainly. But it requires a lot of self-pursuit and trying to educate yourself on what to do. And some people just feel inadequate about it. So we have a long way to go to make the education available, understandable, in a manner that's easily understood and that you can then be help somebody in that situation.
In his book, How Not to Kill Yourself, Clancy Martin, he's a professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri, himself a survivor of multiple attempts, tells us, when I hear that I've helped someone else avoid an attempt, I find more reason to live. Does this motivate you to speak out about this?
It really does. And since the article published in the newspaper, I have had people reach out to me and say, I'm really struggling, Bruce. How do you deal with that? What would your suggestions be? And I'll meet with them readily and give them all the insight and information and recommendations of who to call and who to seek help from as I can. Because when people start talking about that, you're at the edge, I can tell you. If you're talking about suicide, you're at the edge. And I want to be there to the extent that I can be for anyone in that position to let them know there is a way out. There is an escape valve. And there is a path forward. It's not encumbered by illness and permeated with depression and sadness and misery. There is a way forward without all of that. And I think people need to hear that. I think they need to be encouraged because I've been there. So I know what needs to be communicated and the hope that needs to be conveyed. And the thing is, it's more than just hope. It's real. I mean, I'm living it.
Lexington Land Use Attorney Bruce Simpson. Thank you so much for sharing this with us, Bruce.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. The 2023 Governor's Awards in the Arts will be presented 11 a.m. October 13th at the Lyric Theater in Lexington. These awards honor significant achievement in and contribution to the arts in Kentucky. Join us October 13th at the Lyric Theater to celebrate the honorees. The Kentucky Symphony Orchestra will present Dr. Divertimento Unplugged Concert Music, 7:30 p.m., October 28th at Northern Kentucky University's Greaves Concert Hall in Highland Heights. For information and tickets, visit kyso.org. On the Leeds Theater stage in Winchester, Miss Niagara Falls presents Hello Gorgeous, featuring Hell in a Handbasket, My Opinion, and Kristen Mingle. For information and tickets, visit leedscenter.org. I'm Sherry Lawson, now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
If you just joined us, our focus this week is on suicide. When we talk about this on the radio, we offer a number to call, 988, for people who do have suicidal ideation and really need some help or just want to talk to somebody who doesn't have a personal stake in it and can offer the perspective of an outsider who really understands this kind of thinking. You can also contact the Crisis Text Line by texting TALK to 741-741. Earlier in the hour, we heard the story of Bruce Simpson, a prominent Lexington attorney who earlier this year, through a series of unforeseen circumstances, survived his own attempt to end his life. It was reported by Beth Musgrave in the Lexington Herald Leader, and that had quite an impact in the Lexington legal community and beyond. Yvette Hourigan.
I think Bruce's story is the perfect example of that. I have had so many phone calls since that story about people who are either in that place or about to go to that place who are willing now to get help because someone spoke out and said, you know, I'm a lawyer and he's a great lawyer and I have these problems and I have gotten help and that changes everything.
Yvette Hourigan's work in lawyer mental health, well-being, and suicide prevention has been featured on CNN, Bloomberg, and in The Guardian and The Huffington Post. She is director of the Kentucky Lawyers Assistance Program.
It started in Kentucky after I saw a similar program that was created for doctors in Tennessee, and it was the first in the country for doctors. And we immediately, given the fact that Kentucky has seen many lawyer suicides, certainly too many, everyone is too many, to do this to help our lawyers on a completely anonymous basis.
The idea appealed to former state Supreme Court Justice Bill Cunningham, who had experienced the suicides of several lawyer friends or associates.
Deals with all kinds of emotional and addictive problems that lawyers have, alcoholism, drug addiction. And we also have reached out and tried to deal with the dark depression, the bipolar, the manic depressive aspect of it comes into play. And then suicide is a part of that mental health problem we're trying to deal with.
Yvette Hourigan.
Now, I don't think everyone with depression has suicidal thoughts, and I don't think everyone who dies by suicide is depressed, but I think there's a huge correlation between those two. And I think if we can treat depression and chronic anxiety, that we can reduce the number of suicides that we are seeing. Now, there are things that are circumstantial. Someone has a terrible medical diagnosis or a relationship, a long-time marriage ends, or they lose a spouse. You know, some of those situational things, but it's the grief that's untreated or which, frankly, is very similar to the depression.
There are many reasons why people die by suicide.
Melinda Moore, the EKU psychology professor and suicidologist.
Suicidal people are not a homogenous group of people. They're heterogeneous. So that's why it's really important when we're talking about treatments available, that these treatments can be tailored to the needs of the individual, because there are many different reasons why people could contemplate suicide. So we have to make sure those treatments address those unique needs of that individual.
Attorney Bruce Simpson.
But I know as a profession, our culture of practice needs to change. We need to recognize that depression is a legitimate, serious, significant health issue that attorneys have to face.
Work that requires significant levels of aptitude, sacrifice, and education seem to be at above average risk of suicide, and this includes lawyers. But why? What is it about the profession that challenges the human psyche? Yvette Hourigan.
It is so many things that factor together, and frankly, every lawyer I know, every law student or judge I know encompasses some of these personality types. The perfectionism at all costs, you know, the type A personalities, achieve. You know, a lot of the lawyers in my law school class were number one in their college undergraduate class. And also that we are in a conflict-related profession. There are lots of stressful professions. Being a doctor, a neurosurgeon, is a very stressful profession, but we are singularly a conflict-based profession. And the way that conflict impacts your brain is very different from other day-to-day stressors.
Flight or fight, I guess.
Completely. And that causes your brain to emit adrenaline and cortisol when you get into quote-unquote conflict. And for us, that can be a phone call because we're resolving problems all day, every day. And so we secrete these hormones and it starts compromising the parts of our brain where depression begins. And I think that's a really large part of it.
In 2012, Bill Cunningham, the former state Supreme Court justice, had lost a number of lawyer friends to suicide. It prompted him to sit down and write a blog entitled Broken-Hearted Idealists.
People sworn in lawyers, they go back to the community. They're going to not only make money, they're going to right all the wrongs in that community. In every case they get, they're going to win. Everybody that they represent has been charged with a crime, innocent, you're going to get them all. Every divorce you handle, your client's going to walk away with the lion's share of what is stake. And judges are not going to make any mistake. All the jurors are going to get it right. That constant expectation that are constantly bashed with cold water splashed upon it, it wears lawyers down, and they finally they get a perverted notion of their worth.
In his article, Cunningham wrote of the arena of human tragedy that is the workplace of the lawyer.
Well, you know, most lawyers, not so much your corporate lawyers, but your criminal lawyers and your family court lawyers and even your personal injury lawyers, your country lawyers out here in rural areas or even in the urban centers, big percentage of what they do are human tragedies. They're accidental deaths. There's murders. There's mayhem. There's assaults. There's abuse. There's child abuse. There's young children murdered. Kentucky has one of the worst records in the country for child welfare. And all these are tragedies, and lawyers are called upon to take arms against that sea of trouble. And the sea is so vast, and our boats are so small.
There's a passage in your paper that really struck me. You write that practicing lawyers often have this sinking feeling that all of the late hours and the missed holidays from family and friends and all the endless hours of worry in the end just don't matter, that in the end it all amounts to nothing. How pervasive is that sense?
Exactly. I mean, and I think I pointed out, I spent a long, hard career fighting drugs, illegal drugs. I don't know how many drug cases I prosecuted and sent people to penitentiary. I don't know how many drug cases I sentenced as a judge to penitentiary. I don't know how many drug cases I voted to affirm convictions at the Supreme Court level. And our drug problem today, 50 years down the road, is worse than it ever was. So that's got to give you a sinking feeling. What good did I do? And lawyers have to contend with that, many on a much smaller basis, but lawyers have to contend with that and just keep on going. And as I point out in an article, Tom, we lose perspective. We've got to help lawyers to keep perspective. In that process of fighting that battle, in that process of losing those battles, of having those bad days, over the long haul, lawyers do a lot of good. They do win the case. They do defend the innocent person who's not convicted. They do make somebody's divorce a little bit easier on the children. They do come to the aid of the widow who's been grief-stricken and helped them get through the settling of the husband's estate with much more ease. They do all these things. And over a period of time, they add up, and their existence and their contribution to society is very positive and worthwhile, and their life has not been wasted.
Yvette Hourigan.
It seems that there are a few areas, criminal defense lawyers, family lawyers, trial lawyers who are in court day in and day out. Those types of practices seem to have more rates of suicide. Of course, it's hard to tell because there's been so much stigma. It's been so shrouded in secrecy. We're not really sure how high the numbers are.
Does the stigma that we were talking about that's associated with mental illness, does that keep lawyers from getting the help they need? Are they concerned that it might imply something about their ability to carry out their profession?
I think 100% that is the primary reason lawyers do not seek assistance. They believe lawyers are paid to solve problems. You know, our job as lawyers is to extricate our clients from their problems. We are problem solvers. So, A, that prevents us from asking for help in the beginning because we're the problem solver. And B, if someone believes we're compromised mentally, then we may not be a good lawyer for them. That's what they believe. Now, you know, the truth of that is everyone has a family member or a friend or themselves who have had situational depression or mental health issues. In fact, there was a statistic that said every human being during their lifetime, if they live over a certain age, will have had depression or a mental health circumstance that probably needed treatment.
To what extent would you say that the stigma stems from moral judgments about the condition?
Very much so. Particularly, you know, in the Bible Belt, here in Kentucky, we are a little bit lagging in our mental health understanding of care and treatment. And certainly, you know, we whisper about it and we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about family members who may have taken their lives. And I think that does contribute to it, the mentality that I don't need a doctor. I just need to pull myself up by my bootstraps. You know, I need to get over this. I should feel better. You know, the shoulds and the needs and I cans really eliminates us getting treatment.
Do law schools adequately prepare future attorneys to manage the pressures of the work?
I don't know that you could. I think the law schools are doing a lot better than they used to do. You know, we go into the law schools at least twice a year in every law school, and we talk about the mental health aspects and good mental health. But, you know, there's not a lot to prepare you for the practice of law and what the stressors are going to be. I read a really interesting article, and it said that, you know, lawyers are in a profession where they have to act as caregivers and social workers, only they don't have any of that training. And we do. We manage people in their worst crisis, but we really weren't trained in managing those boundaries.
What can be done? First, what can a person who is having these thoughts do to help themselves?
We know from the research that if an individual who's contemplating suicide can make it through that 20 to 30 minute crisis, that they're more than likely going to live.
EKU suicidologist Melinda Moore.
And this is why it is so important to let suicidal people know that mean safety is important. Addressing access to highly irreversible forms of death is really important. But also having a plan in that moment when you're thinking about suicide. What can you do differently rather than think about suicide? Suicide becomes almost like an addiction. It becomes something that people, sort of a reflex people go to, you know, well-worn tracks in the snow. And if you can come up with a plan in that moment, people you can call, things you can do, you know, take the dog to the dog park, go to the gym, call your best friend. If you can get through that 20 to 30 minute crisis, you're more than likely going to live. But in order to do that, you have to be able to articulate to someone what you're thinking. A professional. People sometimes make it through these crises because of circumstances. They just get lucky. And, you know, they're not able to enact their own death. And that's, they're very, very, you know, lucky, very fortunate to have circumstances sort of come together in such a way that prevents them. But most people that we see in our clinic who are suicidal, we come up with what we call a stabilization plan. Stabilization plan is critical for helping suicidal people learn to cope differently in those moments of crisis, address access to highly irreversible forms of death, and just kind of get through that moment with a plan. But it's got to be something you plan in advance.
Are friends and loved ones often the first to hear from somebody who's considering suicide? And what should we do if we find ourselves in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, so we've got some phenomenal national resources available to us. The national toll-free number 988, the Suicide and Crisis Line, that is a number that if somebody communicates to you, if it's, you know, somebody in your family or a friend or a loved one or just somebody you've just met. I mean, sometimes people communicate these things to strangers, you know, calling that number and asking them, you know, what do I do in that moment? I think listening is really important. If somebody communicates to you that they're thinking about suicide, letting them know that you care and that you want to hear what they have to say. I think not leaving people alone is really important, but it's also really important to get, you know, professional help involved as soon as possible. And I think that starts with, you know, calling 988 or the crisis text line 741-741 and asking them, you know, what to do in that moment.
Former Supreme Court Justice Bill Cunningham.
Keep them talking. Keep them feeling comfortable coming to you to talk to them. Set up regular times to see them. Okay, let's talk about this again tomorrow. And just sometimes I think that they just need somebody to talk to.
What should we keep in mind if and when this conversation does happen? Yvette Hourigan.
Well, I don't think we ever want to minimize where they are, and we don't want to argue with them. And we don't want to get hostile. I think many times we get afraid when we're talking to someone who is expressing these things. And fear oftentimes leads us to anger. So we have to be mindful to be quiet and calm and responsive and not reactive to the individual. And again, just offer them love and support and the understanding that there is help and that most people benefit from that help.
But we may be unprepared for that call from a friend or a loved one. They share that they are having suicidal thoughts, and we may not have been aware of this because generally we're afraid to speak to each other about it.
I think we are afraid to talk about it because there are so many myths associated with talking about suicide. You know, the old myths that if you ask someone if they are contemplating killing themselves, it will make them think about it. It will make them do that. And none of those are true. They're absolutely untrue. I can't tell you how many people I talk to, and when we're talking about their mental health, I will say to them, are you contemplating killing yourself? Have you thought of ending your life? And there is almost a look of relief on some of their faces because someone has said it out loud. And they'll say, yeah, I have thought about that. And we go further and we ask them, you know, do you have a plan? And we talk about interventions. But I think there's real relief for the person who is struggling because people who take their lives, people who attempt suicide, they do not want to die. They want their pain to end.
So often we just didn't see it coming. The research tells us that the perceived need for keeping one's suicidal impulses secret, while understandable, can just encourage these thoughts. According to the studies, perception both of the stigma of suicide and of oneself as deserving that stigmatization greatly increases one's risk of dying by suicide. And later, you learn that this person who confided in you that they were seriously contemplating ending their life has died by suicide.
Anytime it happens, you're just filled with grief and doubt and concern that you didn't say the right thing or you didn't do the right thing.
Yvette Hourigan.
What is tragic is that most of the time there is some sign that something is wrong, but there are times when the circumstances, you just don't see it. You couldn't see it. And then you're thinking, why didn't I see it? But, you know, we're not fortune tellers. We can't always see that.
Well, Yvette, you're working in the legal arena. I think this question really pertains more generally, but do you encounter concerns about the practical consequences of sharing these thoughts, like burdening family and friends or being hospitalized or worrying that if it got out, you'll lose respect in the community?
You know, that's interesting. When I started this job about 12 or 13 years ago, I was very comfortable standing up in a room of 2,000 people and saying, my name's Yvette, I'm an alcoholic, because I've been a sober person in recovery for some time. It was much harder for me to say, my name's Yvette and I have depression that I treat. And I think it's all related to the stigma of our community, of our profession in particular, but also of our geography, where we are and how our community talks or doesn't talk about mental health. So, yes, people have those concerns, but I don't think it's, I think a family member is honored to be able to help someone they love. It is a gift to sit in the chair and someone tell you they need help, and you have the opportunity to offer that assistance.
Is help available for people who have experienced this?
In Lexington, there is a SOS, Survivors of Suicide group, where the families or the loved ones of the individual can meet and share their experience, strength, and hope with one another. All of the local hospice agencies have grief support, which includes survivors of suicide. And it is so helpful for the people who did survive, who are dealing with this unimaginable grief.
For any of us who has been in a situation with a loved one or a friend who is contemplating this, we kind of feel as though we're walking on eggshells, that we have to tiptoe around it. But what you're saying is that it's okay to be direct about it.
I think it is. And I think what you want to do is validate their feelings, that, yes, you're in this circumstance, and for whatever reason, you have these feelings. And you validate that, and you say that there is help for you. You know, psychology has this amazing rate of recovery. There are some statistics that I think are as high as 85% of the people who seek mental health treatment have a good result, have a benefit, feel better. Well, there's no other illness or disease that has that sort of response rate.
One who will confirm that is the Lexington attorney, Bruce Simpson, who survived a suicide attempt and got help.
When I started to receive it, and then I started feeling so much better, it was amazing. I feel better now than I've ever felt in my life, and I wish I'd had this treatment 50 years ago.
We heard this echoed in a conversation with Kristen Collins, Chief Operating Officer at the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky.
My father was from Eastern Kentucky. He was from Letcher County and never one to talk about mental health. And he died from suicide. And same with my brother. And mental health was never something that was addressed in our family. And then when that happened, I started going to therapy and still do. And I am more open about it because of these life experiences that I've had. And so making sure that when the foundation and especially myself are in a room with other caregivers, parents, I'm a parent myself, that we're talking about these things openly and making sure that people know that they're not alone. I think that's the number one thing that people think is that they're going through all of this alone, when in reality, they're not.
Terry Brooks' full interview with Kristen Collins will be featured in next week's edition as part of our partnership with Kentucky Youth Advocates for a series on mental health. In the early days of the pandemic, there was a lot of speculation that if prolonged, the social and psychological effects would bring some big changes.
If anything good came of it, it's that the entire country is talking about mental health because so many people have suffered as a result of the isolation and the fear. And so we talk about mental health more than we did. And I think the stigma is falling away. I just think that we're in a profession that it's going to be slower.
Help can be found here at Eastern Kentucky University. Dr. Melinda Moore.
The EKU Psychology Clinic is available. We serve the EKU community, but also Madison County and surrounding counties. We see people both in person and then also virtually. We can provide services really to anybody in Kentucky, although we tend to provide services to people in sort of the central Kentucky area.
As I talk with people who work in this field day in and day out, people like EKU psychologist Melinda Moore, I couldn't help wondering, how do they cope? We talked about professions such as veterinarians or combat veterans who tend to have a high rate of ideation and of suicide itself because their exposure to euthanasia in the case of veterinarians, death and trauma in the case of combat veterans. What about folks in your profession who are dealing with this on a day-to-day, hour-by-hour basis? How do you steel yourself to not take it home with you?
We actually have an ethical mandate to keep ourselves as healthy and as safe as possible. So we take self-care very seriously. Sometimes being in therapy, having colleagues, peers, consultation groups that you can attend to get the kind of support that you need in working with high-risk people. but then also just making sure that, you know, you are taking good care of yourself. These are all really critical for people in psychology across the board. Certainly a non-negotiable for those of us who work with high-risk people. I'm not going to say that people in psychology don't kill themselves. We know they do. But I think that there's an awareness that, you know, vicarious trauma, that we can take this work home with us, and that these things can really threaten not just, you know, our professional judgment and our careers, but they can also impact us, you know, personally. And so it's really important. It's, like I said, it's non-negotiable for us to take care of ourselves.
The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has a Kentucky chapter, and again, there is the 988 Suicide Prevention Hotline available 24/7. These days, Bruce Simpson, the Lexington attorney whose own attempt at ending his life was disrupted by a series of unforeseen intervening circumstances, has come through the experience with a realization of purpose.
Because I have a second chance, and because by all rights and intentions, I should not be speaking to you today, I feel like I have to let people know that the bridge is out down the road, and there's a better and safer path that you can go if you're depressed like I was, and you're at the point of no return, and that you can find happiness, fulfillment. You're not high on drugs. That's not the way medication works. And life can be more enjoyable. And I want people to know that and not go down that point of no return. It is a dark, dark place. You're at the edge, I can tell you. If you're talking about suicide, you're at the edge. And I want to be there to the extent that I can be for anyone in that position to let them know there is a way out. There is an escape valve. And there is a path forward. It's not encumbered by illness and permeated with depression and sadness and misery. There is a way forward without all of that. And I think people need to hear that. I think they need to be encouraged because I've been there. So I know what needs to be communicated and the hope that needs to be conveyed. And the thing is, it's more than just hope. It's real. I mean, I'm living it.
Lean on me when you're not strong.
Thanks for joining us this hour. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine is our studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our contributors, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard online at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.